Welcome to The Appetite, a podcast brought to you by Opal Food and Body Wisdom, where we explore all things food, body, exercise, and mental health. I'm your host for today, Dr. Lexi Giblin. I'm a psychologist and executive director and co-founder at Opal. And we have two special guests today, Maggie Ritnar, who was our first milieu therapist at Opal. And so she has our hearts. She was there from the moment we opened and did some really intense, hard work of helping us establish our world, our milieu world in our treatment center at Opal. So we have a lot of gratitude and love for Maggie. I'd also say that Maggie is my partner in crime for our capture of the Opal Owl. The Opal Owl was across the street on the top of the building across the way, and Maggie and I, back in 2012, 2013, went over, got the owl from the building across the street, and carried it on our shoulders back over to Opal, and it now sits in our dining room at Opal and has ever since. And that is our mascot, of course, the Opal Owls. So that is Maggie's, Maggie's many claims to fame. And then she'll share her other claim to fame at the end of the podcast. And Noni is a colleague of Maggie's. And so I'd love to hear just for both of you to share a little bit more, because I don't know Noni as well as I do Maggie. So share a little bit more about your work.
I guess I'll go. I met Maggie actually, I think back in 2018, when I was working at the Balanced Eating Disorder Treatment Center, and I was a recovery coach there. And I was also trying to figure out too, if I wanted to keep going on the track of being a registered dietitian, or if I was starting to get more interested in becoming a therapist. And I just remember I would watch Maggie doing all of these really interesting things with art and karaoke, and had a really just amazing energy in the center I'd never seen a therapist have before. And I was like, wow, I didn't know therapy would actually be this fun. And so that, like, just working with Maggie and other therapists there just really got me interested in becoming a mental health counselor. So I went to Hunter, I got my master's degree in that. And now I work with Maggie at her practice in Brooklyn, Roots Art Therapy. And I've just been learning so much about RODBT and perfectionism. And it's really exciting to just keep working with someone who's so inspiring.
Mm. Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, Maggie brings some great energy.
Yeah, I remember meeting Noni and her expressing a lot of interest. Like, it was, my biggest memories are the turnover from the cleaning up the art therapy space, and you'd be coming in with snack, I think, or you'd be flipping over breakfast and I'd be setting up for art therapy and then coming in for snack while I was striking art therapy. And you would be interested in like what had happened and like, you know, what I was doing or what we were doing that day. And I remembered what it was like to, you know, clean up spaces or like set up spaces because of my milieu therapy experience. And I loved like sharing with you and hearing like how it might resonate like with the work you were doing, and then talking about the intersection between RD, dietary and therapy. Because of my experience at Opal, like I, you know, the Seattle area had so many crossovers and therapists who were also dietitians. And I thought that was so lovely and cool. So I'm always like tickled to think of like those memories of first meeting you, Noni, and I love working with you. I mean, I could gush and go on. I know that that's not the point of our conversation.
And so Maggie, what's your work right now? You're in New York?
Yes. I live and work in Brooklyn. I have an office in Park Slope. We share an office in Park Slope, Noni and I, and another colleague. And, you know, since the pandemic, things have changed, but I'm an art therapist, first and foremost, and a licensed mental health counselor in the state of New York. I predominantly see folks who have eating disorders. I am a certified eating disorder specialist. And I'm really, I really love RODBT, Radically Open Dialectical Behavior Therapy. I'm a 2020 clinical scholar and like on the road to learning more and becoming hopefully a senior clinician, and have found that that treatment is a lovely crossover between art making and kind of the, for lack of a better word right now, I'm thinking woo-woo aspects of like not having words, but having experiences with folks, especially with eating disorders, but the treatment of RODBT, like having the evidence-based aspects and words that can go along with, you know, seeing progress, looking at increasing flexibility, decreasing rigidity in the application of art. So tangential, like I live and work in Brooklyn and do mostly art therapy and some talk therapy with clients. It's shifted more because of the pandemic, but it was a lot of virtual and in-person stuff in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Cool. Okay. And then I know Noni gave a great talk in 2021 through it with Opal on perfectionism. And so we thought it'd be a wonderful experience for us to sit down and have a conversation about perfectionism and RODBT, since we're all RODBT people and work with eating disorders. And perfectionism, of course, is such a core piece of what we're working with on the daily with our clients. I'm wanting to open the conversation. I'm wondering if we might tackle the question, what is perfectionism? When someone says I'm being perfectionistic, what are we trying to say here today? Like, what are we working? What's our working definition? I guess I was thinking about some of the differences between perfectionism and excellence. I know we talk a lot about that in our in the exercise and sport program at Opal. This difference between doing your personal best with excellence versus working towards an ideal that can never be achieved with perfectionism. So when we're talking about perfectionism, I think we're going to be really talking about folks who have, there's a rigidity to their desire to achieve the top of whatever they're doing or whatever it is that's that happening in their world in the moment. And there's a clear product or destination, an endpoint. And that endpoint is never satisfactory, right? So you get there and it's not quite good enough, or it can never be perfect. So then you're never satisfied, because of course nothing will stay as you think it should, right?
Yeah. I mean, it makes me think of being driven to be perfectionistic. It doesn't, even if you do achieve whatever goal you might have put out there, it oftentimes doesn't warrant, in my experience of perfectionism and experience of working with people, it doesn't warrant slowing down and celebrating that excellence can. So I really like the differentiation between the two. Noni, I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I've not heard that often about distinguishing between perfectionism and excellence, but I think that's a really good point to bring up, because most of my clients who I talk to, I think for them that's confusing as well, is what is being excellent at something and what is trying to be perfect at something. And what I notice, especially even in myself dealing with my own journey of perfectionism, is what Maggie was saying, like being able to slow down and celebrate those moments when you are doing things and you achieve something. But a lot of the times it's so easy to just go, oh, that's not that important. Or, okay, I got that. Let's change the goal now and make it more, you know, complicated or something else I need to strive towards. And perfectionism just becomes like this obsession, it seems like, with wanting to be a certain kind of image or to please people or to create a lifestyle that might not be sustainable, but it keeps you feeling like you're productive, or you're like kind of getting on this productive treadmill, but you're not really getting, I guess, somewhere meaningful or purposeful for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right. This compulsive striving that comes with perfectionism. I love, Noni, what you use the word celebration, and I love that because I think about with excellence, you celebrate your end goals. You know, when you achieve something, mm-hmm. there's a celebration, and in perfectionism, when you achieve your goal or your number, usually that goal just becomes more stringent, right? Mm-hmm. So I love thinking about excellence as being like a space of celebration. I'm also thinking that the differences between excellence, one of the core differences between excellence and perfectionism is the emotional source of those behaviors of behavior of excellence versus a behavior of perfectionism. So I'm thinking like perfectionism, you're sourcing shame. And in perfectionism, the emotion is just like an interest and excitement about life and wanting to get the most out of life. They're very different feelings.
Yeah, that reminds me of teasing out in RODBT. So not to jump into like the themes, but like teasing out the difference between like admiration and envy of like, I think that there can be a slippery crossover between excitement moving into like the anxiety of like, how will I be perceived or what are other people thinking that move from excellence to being more perfectionistic, which I believe often crosses over. I mean, I know I have to be careful for myself when I start to cross over between striving with excitement and then suddenly like shifting into this like autopilot where the end goals become more stringent or just become like further in away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, the differentiating between the source of where it starts, which it connects to what you both were saying about like the obsessions or compulsions that can be more associated with perfectionism when it's sourced from shame.
Yeah, I think like, especially the word shame comes into play for perfectionism. I think that causes just a lot of pain. It feels like for a lot of people, whether it's any kind of self-harm, especially with eating disorders, it's always to me seems like a punishment of not feeling like you're a good enough person, you have to be punished for that in some kind of way, or even in just like a lot of needs to please other people and not acknowledging your own needs, just wanting to feel like you're fitting in or belonging, even if it means you're going to burn out or exhaust yourself emotionally and physically. So that to me, I think, is what makes perfectionism feel kind of like, I don't know if the word is icky, but it's just like, it doesn't feel good now. I think as I've learned more about it and I'm like not trying to be that type of striver as a perfectionist, but it just feels like it comes from a lot of pain that mm-hmm. you feel like it's just never good enough and that you always have to be working on yourself in order for to like accepting yourself or order for other people to accept you.
Yeah.
And you know, with shame, there's often like the secret component, like that it like thrives in secrecy. And so like a lot of perfectionism now, I mean, it's in the age of social media, I mean, I feel like I've noticed it more. And that might also be just the age that I am in life and the work that I'm doing. But it seems like it's more insidious. Like it's everywhere, this like pressure to be perfect. And yet people are kind of talking about it, but they're still struggling with it. Like we as humans are all kind of struggling with it. And we're also clinicians. And the kind of like secrecy that becomes part of that, like, I'm not going to tell people that it's something that I'm struggling with, but I am struggling with it, can be part of the problems of being reinforced by society or by family or culture or, you know, different environmental pressures it can be reinforced and therefore like become, I think we'll probably talk about like maladaptive coping, which just kind of leads to this vicious cycle of like keeping it hidden, but also really struggling with it and feeling so isolated and like ashamed that you're not actually achieving the thing that you want, which is now far distanced away.
Right, right. I think I love thinking about perfectionism the birthplace of perfectionism being shame. And then, as you said, the hiding that comes with shame and this feeling that there's something wrong with us. And this perfectionism as a way to try to hide the truth, this inadequacy that we see in ourselves when we're in that space. And I can think of times in my life where I'm working from a perfectionism place, and it is just, I'm feeling really low about myself. And so I developed this like perfectionistic kind of plan of like, okay, here's how I'm going to take care of, I'm going to address all of these problems in this particular way. And it has a very different feeling from just kind of feeling like, where do I want to go in my life next? Mm-hmm. I'm curious about where I'm headed and who I'm going to be and how I'm developing and growing. You know, the feeling that it comes from is one of a lot of hurt and pain. And I'd also say like unwarranted shame, as we talk about in RODBT, right? This is usually the birthplace of shame, or the birthplace of perfectionism in shame is usually unwarranted shame, in that the person's actually, there's actually not anything wrong with them, right? So this is a false positive of shame. So the person's actually okay, but they don't believe that to be the case. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about why it's so important to appear perfect, like what is, or to be a certain way. Why is that so important from an RO perspective? Why do humans care so much?
Because we don't want to be alone. I mean, from an RODBT perspective, RO talks about like the evolutionary hardwiring in our brains of, you know, these old like communities or tribes that we were historically a part of, and how our, you know, social ostracization would mean certain death for an individual. And we still function from those places. And it feels like that. I mean, we feel like that when we're definitely in that kind of preteen, adolescent, teenage brain stage of like not wanting to be alone. But I've also seen it currently in the uncertainty in the pandemic of feeling so isolated, and like a spike of perfectionism, because I wonder if people are feeling, have felt so isolated and alone. Anyway, I'm tangenting. The question was, from an RODBT perspective, why would people not want to feel this shame, or why would unwarranted shame happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed it with that, Maggie, just that this is at its core about belonging, right? And avoidance of loneliness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's sort of, perfectionism as an attempt at belonging and finding people.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Maggie, if you wanted to go. I'm actually just thinking about my cat right now, because my cat is a very vocal creature, which is very unusual for cats. And we were trying to figure out why he was like put up for adoption, because his last owner said he was aggressive. But I think just having this conversation about why people try to be perfect is not wanting to be rejected. I mean, if my cat had a more complicated brain, maybe he would feel more shame about being a pretty vocal cat and not like other cats. But because he's not like that, he'll just be himself. But I think for most human beings, like what Maggie was saying, we don't want to feel rejected by the larger community or society. So we'll do things that we think are socially acceptable, you know, like not showing a lot of feelings or emotion, not being a person who's needy or clingy. I hear clients say that all the time, especially about dating. I don't want to seem clingy. I don't want to seem needy. So I won't say what I want to this person. But like, that's the only way you know, like what your community is or who's part of your tribe. Like what RO talks about with finding your tribe is if you actually express vulnerable parts of yourself. But I think we just are brought up a lot, especially in Western culture, to be pretty inauthentic in order to connect and belong in a group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, inauthentic is a is the word, isn't it? Because you're not perfectionism drives you to not be yourself. So then whatever you are putting out there is not actually a true representation of yourself. So you're not going to feel connected because what you're putting out there isn't actually you.
Yeah. And you said something a little bit ago, Lexi, about when one is feeling perfectionistic, it might be kind of like a superficial or catch all for other stuff that's going on. When I heard your words, it made me think of like uncertainty, like what is the direction of my life? And I know for me, that is generally where I feel more perfectionistic tendencies coming. Like I want to study more. I want things to look a certain way and be a certain way when I have uncertainty happening. And I just lost my train of thought.
That really segues us nicely into talking about the over-control temperament, because uncertainty and over-control are very much so related, right? Let's talk about why over-controlled folks, and for those of you who don't know about over-control, the over-controlled temperament, we're talking about a temperament that tends to be more emotionally inhibited, behaviorally inhibited as well, perfectionistic, risk averse. Let's see, lots of other things, but commonly can be thought of as sort of a type A personality, someone who's just neurobiologically prone to function in the world from a more inhibited kind of place. How would you all think about, how can we think about why over-controlled folks are maybe more prone to perfectionism? Because I'm sure under-controlled folks are also perfectionistic, but why is this more of an OC thing?
Folks who are over-controlled are more risk-averse. You know, they have the evidence shows that in the research that there's more of a threat sensitivity and more of a, so they're likely to be more hyper-vigilant in their environment because of their biology, predisposed biology, and more aware of like discrepancies and minor like things that are off, reading things as a threat when they're not necessarily a threat, when they might be an ambiguous signal, which can make folks more prone to thinking before they act and able to do that in a way that sometimes we need to learn how to think before we act in life. I mean, we teach our kids to do that. But it can become for people who are, their brains are already kind of hardwired to in those ways to not act in those ways. It can be more problematic when, especially when there is reinforcing in society or families' environments that says, yes, we don't want you to be the squeaky wheel or the vocal cat, Noni's example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still a beginner of RO. So Lexi, when you brought up that under control people can still be perfectionist, I was like, oh, really? Like, it's interesting. Like, I didn't know that before. And I guess that's not who I usually work with. So I don't always think of that, I guess, in that case. But I think also what Maggie brought up about, especially the biological component of like someone who has an OC temperament, because I think when I was learning about RO, especially from Maggie, I was trying to figure out like, well, is it my family environment? Was it like growing up in the city that, I don't know, like some, or the time period I was born that kind of fed into that OC for me a little bit. But I also recognize that I identify as a highly sensitive person. I didn't know what that was for a very long time. Until I started seeing my therapist. And I think being highly sensitive just made me more aware and actually risk averse. Like I don't like taking a risk. And I always think about all the different factors that go into a decision before I make a choice. So then I realized like, yes, that is part of my biology. My nervous system is different. I just pick up on things on environment, even if it's not threatening me, I might think something is a threat. And then I find it interesting too, that a number of my clients identify as being very sensitive people. So they will pick up on things in dialogue that they think is a threat, maybe just based on tone or the speed of something that something is said. And they might go, oh, wait a minute, like, am I being threatened right now in that situation? But it's just interesting how we all have different ways of reacting to things, and that feeds into us being over controlled, I guess, or under controlled.
Mm-hmm. Noni, I wonder also, it sounds like, as I understand it, one of your areas of interest is perfectionism and the intersection between perfectionism, over control, and Black women. Could mm-hmm. you speak a little to how you see that intersection playing out, what that looks like?
Yeah, I remember I was talking to Maggie about how learning about RO was like a huge paradigm shift for me. It was so different than how I was raised as a young Black girl growing up in New York City. I mean, New York City is already a pretty intense city to live in, but just being a Black girl or a Black woman, I was taught you're not supposed to be vulnerable. You're not supposed to express certain parts of yourself. You're not supposed to trust certain types of people. So when I was learning about RO and how to actually change your physiology in order to show that you are open to making connections, that was like, wait a minute, but that's so different than how I was taught to engage with the world. But I think it was just such a nice way too of getting permission to be more of myself, like being more authentic, because authentically I'm very open and warm, but I was always taught not to be that way. So I think learning about RO was just such, I don't know, it was like such a nice relief, I think, from like how I was raised and taught about how to show up in the world. And I also have clients of color who always talk to me about how they don't even trust like white clinicians in the medical field because of their experiences. And it's just really interesting having that conversation about, you know, we can be successful people, especially as Black women or women of color, but not to the point where we're actually hurting ourselves or sabotaging our health in a certain way. But I think that's because we're always raised that we have to look out for ourselves, that we're not usually comfortable with being vulnerable in other relationships.
Mm-hmm. I love that it RO gave you permission to share yourself. It kind of said, like, this is how to be connected in a way that was in conflict with the messaging you'd received growing up. Yeah. Love that. What about the impact on relationships, perfectionism and relationships? Let's talk about it. I'm thinking about what perfectionism looks like from a social signaling perspective. Like, what does it look like to be perfectionistic to the fly on the wall? What do we see, and how does that impact our social realm?
I think what's I find fascinating about, especially if you're someone who's pretty perfectionistic, how it comes up in relationships is that it makes it very difficult for someone to be vulnerable and then to actually connect with other people. I didn't think I would talk so much about relationships as a therapist as much as I do now. I thought like, oh, I didn't study marriage and family therapy, so that's not really going to come up. But it comes up every week like, with every client about, they ask me, how do I get closer to this person? I don't feel like I'm really connecting with people, or they're just really frustrated that even though they are very, I guess, type A personalities, they're still not having relationships that are very intimate and satisfying for them. But I think it's probably the need to look like you can keep your composure, that you're not dependent on other people in order to survive, which is like very backwards because we all need that. But I think that's definitely what comes up with people who are dealing with perfectionism, is trying not to need others in order to be seen as being very independent, very self-reliant, self-sufficient people. But in the end, it makes you very lonely and isolated. And so that just goes against who we are as human beings. We're social. So this idea of having relationships but not wanting to depend on people just doesn't really go together.
Yeah. Lexi, when you first asked the question, I was thinking, well, if you do it perfectly, if you socially signal perfectly, you're not going to have any problems. And that might be a thought a lot of people have, or not even like a thought, but like this unconscious belief. Yeah, a lot of people are so lonely. There's such a desire to not be alone from folks who are looking for relationships and how they're presenting themselves on a dating app, that there is this like strive toward like what picture and comparison with like other photos that are out there or previous photos of themselves, in all for like hopes of being more connected to another person, or comparing yourself to other people's like social media feeds, even the amount that one is posting or like the likes that can happen. It's loneliness is such a part of it. Like we strive to, we talked about this earlier, not be lonely. And a lot of what kind of interplays in the clients that I've seen, especially folks with eating disorders, is this desire to not be a burden, to not like share more about what's really happening, because you don't want to burden someone else with the extent of how you feel emotionally or what's actually happening in your life behaviorally or interpersonally. And often it comes from this place of like being sensitive, I think, with not having an understanding as a person who is sensitive that your feelings will impact someone, because you feel so much on your own, and how that impact socially and signal wise, like this kind of masking that can happen. So with clients or with people, it can happen with both a masking of saying, of not saying anything, like being very superficial in conversations, saying everything's fine when it's not. And sometimes people believe that. Sometimes loved ones are like, oh, everything's fine with this person, or it looks like everything's fine because of X, Y, and Z, you know, grades, what the person, how the hygiene is, you know, what's happening with activities of daily living. And, you know, this person is showing up to work, even working really hard. Or it can, you know, a person can say, I'm fine. And there's like this edge of like, it doesn't seem like they're fine, but they're saying it. Like masking could look like, you know, smiling and nodding and really feeling like you're falling apart, like you're crying on the inside, or that you will cry later that day. Behaviorally, with folks with eating disorders, like not eating what you would prefer to eat in front of specific people, you know, based on what you believe somebody else would say. It's just like,
huge.
Yeah, it is. It's like a, it resonates out.
Right. And I appreciate both. I mean, I think that is the core, right? It's the what it looks like is not being real about what's happening for you in all in various ways, your vulnerabilities. It's not putting the truth out there. And I, you know, I'm thinking about times when I'm around like highly perfectionistic people, or even folks, you know, at Opal, clients at Opal, where there's the strong perfectionism kind of vibe in the room, and how that impacts me. Like I often feel like if I'm around someone who's highly perfectionistic, I'll often find myself more inhibited around them as well, because I don't want to do the wrong. I try to also be perfectionistic because I don't want them to judge me about mistakes I might make. So in the social realm, it seems like it kind of breeds this inhibition all around the person, not just the person's expression of themselves, but those around them. There's like a social signal of like, we all need to be very careful here to not let ourselves be known. That's dangerous. Let's keep it on the surface. Let's stay aloof and distant, and let's critique ourselves. And with that, you know, this assumption that when we critique ourselves, I'm also critiquing other people, right? Mm-hmm. So I often think of that, the perfectionism, like the group perfectionism vibe, and how uncomfortable that is, and how little play there usually is in those scenarios as well. There's not a lot of fun, flexibility, risk-taking happening, like genuine, like guttural laughter, right? Yeah. Those are the places where you're free in letting yourself just not be too concerned, right?
Yeah. Gosh, Noni, it's reminding me of the conversation we had the other day about feeling fatigued when in this work. And sometimes like feeling like we're not doing enough, and that's so that's such a real place. And sometimes that's a, like our own barometer saying like, that's not necessarily about us talking about our own perfectionism, but it's oftentimes like, yeah, this reaction or response to what's happening in the quote unquote room with the client or with people who are engaging in perfectionism.
Yeah, I'm thinking of too, like when Lexi, you're talking about being in a group and how that comes in the energy of the group. I did a group with some teen girls about perfectionism. And it was really funny how I thought it was going to be really difficult. Like, okay, these are girls who are pretty controlling and they might not want to talk too much or might want to just seem very, like what you're saying, aloof. But these girls had so much to say. It was hard to just cut at time whenever they would just be talking, but they just wanted to connect with someone else to know that they're not alone at a very young age that they're going through this. But I've been in groups with older adults and it's a very different energy. It's like, I don't know what it is. Maybe developmentally people just are more aware of keeping their composure or an image in front of other adults, but it's a little more serious. I think when I've been in groups with adults and the perfectionism is a lot more open in the air than I think with the younger people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with the younger people, by the way, I just got off a 1 week vacation with two teenagers, a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old, 1 week solid, just me with them. And the intensity of the self-consciousness is, it was up there. And I guess it's probably, there's some perfectionism in it. It's also just seemed like a normal developmental stage, Noni. But the thing that really connected with me with what you just said is sort of once you get them going, if you can get one of them to start to share something vulnerable, then they will start. They just are really wanting to connect in a real way. It's about kind of feeling like it's going to be okay to do so. But if you can get that going, it's amazing to watch the openness happen and the relief that comes with, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. And they're also fallible and feeling inadequate.
Yeah, absolutely. I even have felt that way as an adult, like listening to podcasts. I mean, especially like this podcast, why I love The Appetite is because y'all share real examples of your life. And it feels like, oh, they're real people. Like they're people who I admire, not just the podcast, but like what you're doing as a profession. And they're opening up and it allows permission. I mean, it makes me think that you probably gave that to your, you know, the group, Noni, with the kids, and that's likely what started the fire. And yeah, when one person does that, and we can do that as clinicians, it's almost like it's sometimes harder in real life. It isn't sometimes, it often feels harder to do that in real life because it is a risk.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why on Friday mornings Facing Fears, every time we do karaoke, there's a reason I start it off, right? There's a reason I do the first song, and it's not because I want to. It's because I know somebody's got to break the ice, you know, and then maybe my social signaling will invite others to be playful and put themselves out there and show their goofball side, their true side of themselves for that hour. But no, I think that's such a big part of it. Someone's got to break, start the chain of sharing, you know. Okay, all right. So this is great. Maggie, you just learned that your sound quality is not going to be perfect on this podcast. How are you doing?
I'm feeling self-conscious because I can't hear. I don't know what the blurb sounds like. I know that it's off-putting to others, so I'm more self-conscious, like that it's impacting what might be a desirable outcome. I don't feel any pressure to change on my end because I don't have any options to change, I guess. I don't think. Should I do something different? Oh. Is there something different I can do on my end?
I don't know of anything you could do on your end, Maggie. I think we have to live with it.
Oh, gosh. I'm imperfect and I have to live with it.
Yeah. I think that's the case. But Maggie, I love how you were just real with how you felt about it.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Thanks for telling me what was going on.
Yeah. I actually heard it go out, but I didn't. I was like, well, I don't know if I should jump it. You know, maybe it's my own perfectionism too. Like, should I fix this for Maggie? But then I thought maybe it's fine, on the other end. So I didn't do much about that.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the powers of being imperfect in front of each other and talking about it, and now, Maggie, this is not something you have any control over anyway, is that we can, Noni and I think we're all cool with you still, Maggie. We're not going to reject you or anything like that for this imperfect microphone. So you're still, you're still totally in with us.
Thank you for letting me know. I'm glad. I mean, the social signaling was there, but it's validating to have the words.
Okay, good. Okay, so this helps us segue actually to treatment. What do we do? Yeah. How can we help ourselves and each other and our clients with perfectionism from an RO perspective? What do we do?
Yeah, this is the part, I wonder if I just had the blurb. Well, I said that. This is the part about RO that I really like. You know, it talks about kindness and pointing out potentially problem behaviors in our clients. But before that, we talk about, problematic or maladaptive coping that manifests and targeting, things that the client identifies based on the different themes. Lexi, you kind of mentioned them earlier, aloof, distant, envy, social comparisons, rigid, rule governed, disingenuous, overly cautious, hypervigilant, and how these different themes manifest in a person's life. But aside from that, further on in treatment, we really talk about being in a room or being face to face in some capacity, with masks off, with the metaphoric or figurative masks off, or talking about those masks that may be getting in the way. Like Maggie, I've been noticing, this was a great example of you're here for this podcast today, but your sound is a little off. Is that could that potentially be a social signal? Is that something that you're aware of? It could be off-putting. Depending on the blurp sound, the bloop sound, it may really, what if it were a screech? It could really be off-putting and keep people from wanting to listen to a conversation that I think is, I believe we all agree is a really important one. So talking to clients about and targeting be parts of their behavior that may be keeping them from joining or being fully authentic in a way that is the life that they want to have, right? The life that is in line with their valued goals of connecting with another person or with multiple people.
Right. It's so going opposite to shame, right? Just instead of hiding, revealing yourself.
Yeah.
I was just going to jump in actually when Maggie's talking about the values. And one of my biggest values, I think, as a person and as a professional is humor and laughter and joy. And I bring that into my sessions with my clients because my clients can be very serious about everything, but it's really fun, especially with my clients who are adolescents. I've worked with a number of younger clients, but they are, especially in high school, it's about looking cool. You don't want to seem like an awkward person. So I always tell them, you could just laugh at yourself. If you do something that's kind of weird and awkward, humor can help to lighten it up. And it becomes funny because all of a sudden we're laughing in session about different awkward moments and how do you handle that? but even with my older clients too, because I think sometimes there's this idea that the older you get, the more serious you need to be in order to handle being an adult. But I just keep reminding people, you can have fun. It can be funny if something doesn't go a certain way, or if you react in a certain way that seems not socially acceptable, because it helps just to relax your body and your mind if you're having a good time. But if you're in a social situation, like, I can't ever look like I'm doing something wrong, or I'm awkward, or I'm the weird one, that's, I don't know, you're not really present in situations. So that's something I do a lot with my clients to help them, is adding more humor and laughter into things and not taking everything so seriously like they normally do.
Mm-hmm. Ah, such a huge one. I love that one. Laughing at yourself and playfulness. I also think about self-inquiry. Self-inquiry. I just love self-inquiry. And I think about how impactful it can be to intervene in the original emotion before you start down the perfectionistic project list, holding a moment for yourself to explore the unwanted emotion that is at the heart of that urge to do better or do something differently, do something perfectly. What sitting in that emotion for those 3 to 5 minutes, of course, with self-inquiry, where we ask ourselves the question, what's the learning here, rather than going to a solution, right? The solution of perfection, considering what's the learning of this emotion and discomfort, rather than what's the way to solve the problem of me. You know, it's such a different way of going. So I think self-inquiry is such a rich tool for perfectionism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I love that you said that you love it. I think a lot of clients that I work with don't love self-inquiry, at least at first. And that's because there is no perfect answer in self-inquiry. And sometimes you don't have an answer. I mean, that is what the goal of self-inquiry, to have more questions, which in itself is a kind of exposure, a dismantling, an exposure to being imperfect. Not having an answer feels imperfect.
Yeah.
And that process of being with that for 3 to 5 minutes is life-changing. I mean, it really can change our physiology to be exposed to that for short amounts of time.
Right. I mean, I know when I'm in a perfectionistic mode, when I figure out how to solve the problem of this inadequacy that I've identified in myself, there's an automatic decrease in my anxiety. Like, oh, it's going to be better soon. You know, I've got the problem is solved. Now I just have to execute. And such a different space than the self-inquiry space, right? Where you're just, it's chaos and ambiguity and there's no answer, and it's not, you actually feel worse when you're done. It's not a closed regulating practice at all, of course, inherently. So I do think of perfectionism as being so rewarding in that way, the immediate decrease in anxiety. Oh, I've got the problem solved. I don't have to be inadequate forever, you know? And that's part of what makes it so challenging to let go of, right? Because it is so so soothing at first.
Absolutely. It's harder, I mean, because it's intermittently rewarded. Like, sometimes you can achieve all the boxes on your to-do list are checked, and or all the emails are answered, and it feels so nice to just have the things put away. But that's not life. Life is chaotic and uncertain and full of imperfect and times that don't feel easeful. So to practice on a regular basis self-inquiry, which can be a way to practice feeling dysregulated, is the way out, and it's so uncomfortable.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree with that. When I first learned about self-inquiry from Maggie, I didn't really understand it because I'm so used to journaling for a very like long periods of time to ruminate and figure things out. So when she was saying, oh, 3 to 5 minutes, I was like, but that's not enough time to really like figure your life out in 3 to 5 minutes a day. But I think the more I practice it, the more I started getting more comfortable with that uncertainty and the unknown. Because I don't like feeling like I don't know certain things. But I think that's a real challenge, and also the reality of life. Like you both were saying, you're not always going to get all the answers at once, no matter how organized or structured of a person you are. And can you lean into that and actually just use it as an opportunity to learn more about yourself or your relationship with anxiety and the unknown? And I do some self-inquiry sometimes with clients, like the actual formal journaling practice. And then with other clients, it's more about asking them questions to get them to that edge of, am I challenging myself of not needing to have an answer? Because a lot of my clients are like, oh, yeah, great, I got it. You know, that's fine. I'm going to try that and it's going to work out great. Or, oh, this is the perfect relationship. I don't need to look anymore for anybody else. It's like, it might not be. You can keep exploring and see what comes up. And you can always change your mind too if something is not resonating with you or it's not going in a direction you feel comfortable with. You can change direction. But I think especially if you're a perfectionist, you feel like there's only one way to handle things, and even if it's not working, you have to stick it out anyway.
Mm-hmm. And that's such a signal to other people, like this being willing to not have the answers is such an openness that it's a clear, I mean, as Noni's sharing, it's a clear like connection between intimacy and, you know, this vulnerable connection of being imperfect. And in the moment, it's like, so I get so focused on like, I have the answer. And so there's no other way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wild how hard it is to actively like engage in self-inquiry.
One of my favorite questions when perfectionism is coming up in self-inquiry for myself, and I'll throw it out to others if at times as well, is, what are you trying to hide? Because perfectionism, I think of as an attempt to hide something, you know, at its heart.
I'm going to write that one down.
What are you trying to hide from me? Or what are you trying to hide? I love that one for myself. Okay. Is anything else that you two would like to be sure to get in?
I think there was one thing about, especially if people have eating disorders and relationships, there was one thing I wanted to share.
Yes, please.
Something I find really interesting, especially with the clientele I work with who have or live with eating disorders, is that a lot of them are trying to create new relationships that are more intimate, but they're also trying to hide the fact that they have an eating disorder from someone new. And just the whole conversation we were having about, you know, how shame thrives in secrecy. It's just interesting how a lot of them are trying to figure out, how do I keep this secret and also build a bridge with another person, which it's confusing for them. But then ultimately I tell them, you might want to disclose that that's something that you live with, because it will affect the relationship. But it's interesting how the fear of vulnerability is, how do I keep certain secrets from people and still pretend that I can connect and be fun and intimate with this person, even though there's like a Pandora's box that I just do not want to open, because what if I do and then I'm rejected and I lose this person? So I think that's something I'm learning a lot about in this work that I didn't really know about before. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for that, because yeah, eating disorders are there and there's so much secrecy involved. And then how does that get in the way of connectedness? Well, you are more under control, and which is one of the things I love about you, Maggie. And with that, I know that you'd probably be willing to give us a little comfy pants dance.
Yeah, I'm going to move my table. I hope it doesn't make a noise.
Okay.
I feel like I should do the video. I should share. I mean, hopefully you can see me.
So Noni's never seen this.
No, mm-hmm. And that's why I feel like I want to make sure.
She want to make sure she can see the full.
She can see the whole thing. I don't know if you can see. You can't see my feet. Okay, this is my comfy pants stance. Comfy pants, comfy pants stance. Comfy pants, comfy pants stance. Comfy, 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 comfy.
Yes, I love that.
It can go on, but I feel like it's not necessary right now.
It can go on and on and on, and it's gone on in my mind for about 10 years now. So thank you for that gift of the comfy pants dance, because I'll put my comfy pants on and do a little Maggie comfy pants dance.
I'm glad I wore them.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect.
It would be inappropriate to do the comfy pants dance without.
No. Yeah, no, you can't
with anything
fake
else.
It. You can't fake it. You got to have them.
It would be social signaling that just wouldn't match.
No, no.
The words.
Well, I loved my time with both of you. Noni, great to meet you. And Maggie, good to spend time with you. Thank you for this conversation. You brought up some great ideas and have my thoughts bubbling.
Thanks so much. It's always fun. I love talking about perfectionism because it's such a serious topic, but it's good to bring some light to it as well.
Yeah.
I love talking about perfectionism when I'm doing it imperfectly. Thank you so much for inviting us.
It was really fun. Okay, thanks for joining us today on The Appetite. We're back. And for more information on Maggie and Noni's practice, go to Roots Art Therapy. We will link it in our show notes as well. Until next time.